So good morning, everybody. And we're on page 418, paragraph beginning, in our valuation of the movements of our consciousness. And at this part of the chapter, Sri Aurobindo is taking account of the undivine, as he calls it here. So he has set up this the big duality of our experience here, which is one of the divine and the undivine, as he calls it, which has been seen as one of the reasons for positing a kind of a completely dualistic worldview of good and evil. Even in the Vedas, we have this notion of the Devas and the Asuras who are battling all the time. But there is, along with that, the other side, which is that this is not an absolute duality. It is a relative duality, which is part of the condition of our existence in this evolving ignorance, as he calls it. So over here, he's trying to take account of this by pointing to the operations of the absolute or of the one that he has already highlighted earlier. And we talked about that the last time when we were studying, which relates to the fact that that the divine or Brahman has these operations, or actually the operations of Maya within Brahman, which have to do with self-limitation, the power of concentration, or of self-variance, or variance of consciousness, and finally of self-prospection. In other words, the ability to view its varied possibilities, its infinite possibilities, in a sort of a concentrated form, and from each of these forms presenting itself as the totality. So this leads to a kind of a creation of multiplicity. According to the Upanishads, if we look at the Isha Upanishad, this is what they call avidya. Avidya does not refer in its truth to the sense of separation. It actually refers to the sense of multiplicity. But multiplicity can coexist with the experience of the oneness of the divine. And that is the truth of the avidya, you may say. Now, along with that, there enters some effects. And one of those effects is a kind of a reflected identity of the self-prospection and self-limitation of the divine. So these three properties that we are talking about, one of them is, the ability to reduce oneself into monads, what some of the Enlightenment philosophers like Leibniz called a monadology. The ability to become atomic, to become individualized centers, infinite individualized centers of self-presentation. So this self-limitation through self-concentration also includes a kind of variance of consciousness, so that self-limitation through self-concentration can have different degrees of consciousness up an infinite ladder. And then into each of these self-limitations or self-concentrations, the entirety of the Brahman can present itself and also exist as a point of self-existence. So point of being, then, and that would be self-prospection. It becomes like the center of its own universe. Each one of these would become the center of its own universe. So we find that this kind of situation has arisen, and so that in each of these there is the oneness and the infinity of the divine that is present. The divine is one and infinite in each of its self-varied levels of consciousness. The divine is one and infinite in each of its self-concentrations. And the divine is one and infinite in each of its individuations. See? But inside each of these individuations, there also enters an effect. And that effect is a surface effect, as he says, which is the result of the ego, or we may say which results from the ego. The ego itself is the result of that particular formation, and the consciousness which takes on a sort of puppet mask for its operation as a play of multiplicity within each of these ranges of consciousness. So this is how Sri Aurobindo is going to account for the existence of the avidya as a multiplicity or a play of multiplicity with the effect of separation, which brings all the problems that we face as the undivine. The problems of the undivine, which is that of radical separation and of existence and non-existence, disappearance from the existence, the semblance of death. So that is where we stand right now, as Sri Aurobindo has discussed this. And we can start from this paragraph. You know, in our valuation of the movements of our consciousness, and maybe Margaret, would you like to start us off?
Debashish, yes. When you were speaking about the separation of the ego, yes. And I think you used the word masks.
Yes.
It seemed to me that, well, two things. One, that in all cultures that masks play such a prominent role in maybe expressing the divine or forces of the divine, but somehow the perception of that separation is the key in some ways to whether you're in the divine perception or the undivine perception. But anyway, the masks part seemed to be particularly important in world culture and how that's perceived as well.
Well, yes, you're right, Margaret. And actually, we have to think about this. It's quite a profound, consideration, this whole consideration of masks. Because on the one hand, if we think about masks as a certain effect, in other words, it's a masked divine. The divine masks himself to appear as separate entities or individualities and create the conditions through which a certain play of multiplicity can occur, in which concealment is the key. There is self-concealment in masks, but there is also self-revelation in masks, because in each of these masks, there are certain qualities that are being presented as the face and form of the divine. So that is the condition. And because there is a variation of consciousness, in each of these levels of consciousness, the mask has its own consciousness. And this consciousness, as it were, fronts the self-concentration of the divine. We can think about levels of masking in which the mask is conscious of the wearer of the mask. That distinction, there is no veil between the mask and its wearer. The wearer has become the mask, as it were. But we can also think of levels of consciousness in which the mask is not aware of the wearer of the mask, and going down to a self-limitation, which is completely inconscient, in which there is only the mask. And the wearer has sort of, as it were, become completely latent and automatic in the movements of the mask. On the other hand, when we talk about world cultures, we are talking about alterity. We are talking about altered states of consciousness. In other words, wearing a mask invites a different view. And so that kind of effect where you are brought face to face with another reality within this reality is conducive to a different kind of operation of consciousness, where we, as it were, move away from the habitual conventions of our reactions and interactions. So I think there is a kind of a inversion of the ontology of masks when we actually wear masks in a world culture, as you said. See, so it's a very interesting, very profound area of consideration, which really arises from the fact that the divine masks himself. In Shaivism, it's very interesting that the kind of operations of the Brahman we were talking about are configured differently in different kinds of metaphysics. And in the Shiva metaphysics, the properties of Shiva that are given are not just creation, preservation, and destruction, but two more, and those are self-concealment and self-revelation. So these properties of self-concealment and self-revelation form this ladder of consciousness by which the divine can wear masks, and the masks can take on an appearance of reality, not only to the observer, but to the wearer himself. He conceals himself to himself, as it were, and experiences the world as a world of limitation, concentration, and self-prospection. And so that kind of experience is what Sri Aurobindo is coming to. At one level, the undivine, as we may call it, is not an effect that is experienced by something other than the divine, but by the divine himself. It is we, as the divine, who experience the undivine.
Wow. So on one other point, it seems like as you're talking about the concealment and the revelation, that there's an evolutionary movement inherent in that.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's also an infinity. So in each of these operations, we have to look at the self-presentation of the infinite one. In each of them, there is a oneness and an infinity simultaneously present. In each layer of consciousness, if we talk about layers of consciousness, we are already talking about something which is discrete. We think about the properties of matter, life, mind, etc. These are discrete ranges of consciousness. It's almost like condensations of different kinds of properties that are stacked up one on top of the other. But the interfaces between these discrete levels are fuzzy, and it is really a kind of a continuity, a complete, like a ripple that exists right from the base to the top without end. There is no bottom and there is no top to it. And so it is a kind of a sort of, if there were to be only self-variation, there wouldn't be any discrete ranges of consciousness. There is also self-limitation, so that each of these ranges of consciousness takes on a certain kind of discrete identity. And then there is self-prospection, by which the divine enters into each of these ranges and knows himself as each of these ranges. So each of these ranges is one and infinite. Matter is one, it's matter everywhere, and it's infinite because it can have infinite manifestations of matter. Life is one and infinite. Mind is one and in the same way. And again, you have, like, these ranges can be infinite because the fuzzy boundaries between them are infinite. Because if there is a discrete gap, you can fill it infinitely. And then again, each of the instances that appears, which are the individualities that experience them separately because of the self-prospection of each concentrated appearance of the divine, is again one and infinite. In other words, each individuality is one and infinite, only it seems to be limited and finite in its effect, in its masked effect, in its concealed effect. But in its self-revelation, it shows itself to have infinite depth and connects to the infinity of the one. So this is the way in which the avidya manifests the properties of oneness and infinity of the divine in a variety of ways. Again, if we talk of the cosmos as something which contains this entire, like the envelopment of this entire range of self-variation, that again is one and infinite. So this is the ways in which the divine conceals and reveals himself at the same time.
So there are two things that in our culture that seem to me very much, very closely related to this. And one is our celebration of Halloween, where everybody dresses in masks, and there's a sense of becoming and a sense of either being aware or not aware of the latent self that's behind the mask, and a closeness of other worlds, so that there's an opening, a certain kind of opening to other realities. And the same thing happens when people practice theater, because they step into another world and bring themselves to another reality in order to practice that skill.
Yeah, completely, absolutely, Joanna. That's exactly how masks operate within culture, within world culture, as Margaret was saying. Masked performances are opportunities for experiencing altered states of consciousness, where the familiar becomes put into contact with other possibilities and starts revealing, its latent infinity in that way. At the same time, it's deeper combinations of qualities that are being manifest.
So when you say, like, the mask is aware of, or it becomes aware of the divine or unaware, so that awareness, are you talking of like a mental awareness, or is it something like more primal to it?
No, more primal. The mental awareness is one layer of that awareness. And so actually what we do experience is we experience just the mask. I mean, from the viewpoint not of theater or, enactments, but in our everyday life, we are the mask, as it were. Mm-hmm. Or in other words, there is another property of the divine at play. This is the reason why there is a difference between avidya, as seen by, if we talk about avidya as a truth. So the truth of avidya is really something which is being manifest by supermind. which is why there can be a supramental manifestation of multiplicity. The supramental manifestation of multiplicity contains masks which know themselves to be self-concealments of the divine and self-revelations of the divine for the purpose of a play in multiplicity. But if in that condition a veil intervenes between the mask and the wearer, then we have avidya as we know it. Mm-hmm. And in that avidya, we are the mask, but we don't know who is the wearer.
Yeah.
See, if that veil can be removed, then we can experience things as they truly are. The wearer knows himself to be the mask, and the mask knows itself to be none other than a self-revelation of the wearer.
So then, how does Sri Aurobindo or the mother see that avidya? I mean, for us it is the natural experience, but for them, what is their experience of the avidya?
So it is double, as you'll see in this chapter. Basically, what they're saying is this is the truth of avidya, but this is not how we experience it. The reason we don't experience it like that is that there are these stacked levels of consciousness, this self-variation, which has become discrete due to the self-prospection of the divine in each of these levels, so that there is a very strong force that intervenes between the mask and the wearer. And so for us, we have this distinction, but that distinction exists also as a property of the divine, which is that of the adventure of evolution. And so both these realities, the truth in supermind, let's say, of avidya, where the wearer is the mask, and the truth in the ignorance, where the wearer and the mask are separated from each other, they are both expressing a certain quality of the divine. In the second, the quality is that of aspiration, by which there is a certain evolution that occurs and a progressive growth into the divine, the very essence of time, one may say, the experience of time as we experience it, not the supramental time vision, but the arrow of time, as we may call it. So that kind of experience is something essential, and that experience leads to the other worldview. That's why we have two kinds of worldviews. One worldview in which is monistic. There is only the divine, and we can explain the manifestation in terms of the divine, as Sri Aurobindo has done right now. But from this point in the chapter, he will suddenly flip, and he will say that there is a truth to the fact that there is a entrenched division between the wearer and the mask. And as a result, the truth of that is really that there has to be a struggle, and that struggle is the struggle of consciousness to be born, which is another kind of, you know, you may say, if we talk in terms of theater, which is the very plot of the theater. That is a certain form of the delight of being that experiences its own power. In fact, one may say, you know, sort of echoing Nietzsche, that the will to power is the essence of the avidya. That really it is the ability to express consciousness as power and overcome the undivine. That is the delight coded into separation. Mm-hmm. So for somebody like Sri Aurobindo and the mother, they would be experiencing both at the same time. Mm-hmm. That's why he says from an absolute point of view, everything is the divine. But here, everything is a play of forces. Mm-hmm. That which means basically it is the will to power which is at play. And these two are both simultaneous in their experience.
Thank you, Ashishna. Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sean Lyon started, but...
Oh, please go ahead.
Okay. In our valuation of the movements of our consciousness, this ability of concentration is rightly held to be one of the greatest powers of the human mentality. But equally, the power of putting forth what seems to be an exclusive working of limited knowledge, that which presents itself to us as ignorance, must be considered one of the greatest powers of the divine consciousness. It is only a supreme self-possessing knowledge which can thus be powerful to limit itself in the act and yet work out perfectly all its intentions through that apparent ignorance. In the universe, we see this supreme self-possessing knowledge work through a multitude of ignorances, each striving to act according to its own blindness, yet through them all it constructs and executes its universal harmonies. More, the miracle of its omniscience appears most strikingly of all in what seems to us the action of an inconscient, when through the complete or the partial nescience, more thick than our ignorance of the electron, atom, cell, plant, insect, the lowest forms of animal life, it arranges perfectly its order of things and guides the instinctive impulse or the inconscient impetus to an end possessed by the all knowledge, but held behind a veil, not known by the instrumental form of existence, yet perfectly operative within the instinct or the impetus. We may say then that this action of the ignorance or nescience is no real ignorance, but a power, a sign, a proof of an omniscient self-knowledge and all knowledge. If we need any personal and inner witness to this indivisible all-consciousness behind the ignorance, all nature is its external proof. We can get it with any completeness only in our deeper inner being or larger and higher spiritual state, when we draw back behind the veil of our own surface ignorance and come into contact with the divine idea and will behind it. Then we see clearly enough that what we have done by ourselves in our ignorance was yet overseen and guided in its result by the invisible omniscience. We discover a greater working behind our ignorant working and begin to glimpse its purpose in us. Then only can we see and know, but now we worship in faith, recognize wholly the pure and universal presence, meet the Lord of all being and all nature.
So here in this very beautiful paragraph, he's pointing to a number of things. One is this universal omniscience. One may look at as the divine ecology by which this very complex, separated multiplicity of a variety of levels and qualities is yet coordinated and kept in a certain kind of homeostasis, we may say, that there is a certain type of, intelligence that keeps it in balance. And then he looks at the ranges of consciousness that are even more unconscious than us going down to matter, and shows how the laws of the universe that we kind of take for granted are the sign of the working of a great intelligence, that an omniscience, as he says. Now, there we find that there may be a certain kind of error or you know, operation of a certain ignorance, because it is indeed that fact of viewing the material universe as being logical, rational, containing laws, that has spawned a certain view of the entire cosmos, which is a view of the cosmos being guided by laws. But these laws, absolute laws, determinisms, are only absolute the more unconscious things are. Because the more unconscious it is, the more latent the divine consciousness is, and manifest in the form of symbolic habits. These habits or laws are all symbols, in a sense. But as the ranges of consciousness increase, we find greater free will in these levels. And yet there are determinisms. At each level, there is a determinism which belongs to the way in which the omniscience is guiding that particular universal manifestation. At the highest levels, there is felt to be no self-limitation, because there is the omniscience itself that is freely determining its own freedom. And yet, it is at those levels that you recognize the fact that there is a self-revealing idea. That's why he uses those two terms, idea and will. So the idea is the real idea of supermind, which is the way in which the manifestation is occurring by a certain kind of ordered self-presentation. And the will is the will of the divine, the will to power of consciousness. And so we find that the real proof is not so much, though we can see it as a certain manifestation down even in matter, of this divine omniscience. The true proof of the omniscience is in self-experience. And that's why he says that if we were to look for that true proof, we find it within ourselves. And we can connect, we can see the connection between the mask and the wearer, as we were saying earlier. And so then we see that behind the veil of our own surface ignorance, there is the divine idea and the will. But that is what is manifesting, and we are nothing other than that. Nothing is nothing other than that. Everything is that. And so then we see clearly enough that what we have done by ourselves in our ignorance was yet overseen and guided in its results by the invisible omniscience. So nothing is occurring outside the knowledge will of the divine, or of supermind, because that is the manifesting consciousness of the ignorance. But at the same time, we have to see that the surface effect, which is giving us this experience of the undivine, has its own truth. And that truth is the truth of the aspiration to arrive at that self-knowledge, that it is nothing but the divine knowledge and will at work in the universe. We discover a greater working behind our ignorant working and begin to glimpse its purpose in us. Then only can we see and know what now we worship in faith. Recognize wholly the pure and universal presence. Meet the Lord of all being and all nature. This is the Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. The first line of the Isha Upanishad is the Lord who is present in this turning universe, this changeful universe, in each of its instances. There is nothing but the Lord and his nature. One other point can be observed from this, which is also very important, which is that since he brings in these ranges of consciousness down to matter, and talks about the way in which the divine omniscience works and can be observed to form a certain kind of a harmony out of the chaos, is that in the human, we start finding a level of consciousness which actually breaks from the unconscious harmonies of nature. It is much easier to talk about determinisms and laws that bind matter and even life up to the animal kingdom. We can see that animals have seasonal effects, that they actually behave in largely predictable manners within broad limits. The human can also be said to form similar kind of behavior patterns of a different modality through its mind. But because the degree of freedom is much greater, there is, as it were, a greater rupture from the kind of wisdom, one may say, of nature. And that itself brings a greater sense of the undivine. To even talk about the undivine is not possible until that happens. But on the same token, to be able to talk about the undivine is also the very sign of the ability to aspire for something greater. Otherwise, it would not be possible. If we didn't sense that there could be a perfection, we would not know that there is an imperfection. And it is only because of that that the discontent of the human propels it towards another station of consciousness, where its freedom is known to be the self-choice of the determinism of the divine idea.
So that aspiration for that perfection itself has in it coded the methodology for effecting it, for...
Exactly. That is the other property of the divine, which is at work in the ignorance. Because as Sri Aurobindo points out, the method for this entire revolution, which is secretly present also in the atom, is the aspiration for something greater, which is secretly at work, that calls down the higher levels of perfection into the manifestation, so that there is an evolution possible. The mechanism of the evolution is the double process of the aspiration and the descent. But it happens as if unconsciously in nature, mm-hmm. up to the level of the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And at the human, there is a turning. It's a, you know, kind of a reversal of consciousness, as Sri Aurobindo, the mother uses that term. You know, a reversal of consciousness takes place. This is, in fact, instinctively seen even in the movement that has led us into our own times, modern times, by the thinkers of the Enlightenment, who created a kind of a big shift in knowledge, because before that, in the West, the idea was that everything is perfectly seen or conditioned by the divine. That also continues today in what is called the idea of intelligent design, that something from outside has made everything perfect. And we could see that in, and as he's saying, if we look at matter, we can see that there is a certain kind of wisdom or a power, a divine ecology at work. But at the same time, what we find is that in the human, those laws don't operate anymore. Mm-hmm. We have broken from the homeostasis of nature. But at the same time, because of that, we have become agents of a new kind of change. So the real shift that took place during the Enlightenment, or one of the big shifts that took place, the other big shift was the movement from a belief in a transcendental creator to belief in reason. Okay. And they equated reason with the transcendental. So the logos, the divine order, became something that was embodied in the human as human reason. But along with it came the idea, the theology, that God had created the universe not perfect, but imperfect, with the human being seeded with the divine faculty of reason by which it could perfect that imperfect world. So we became agents of the divine in furthering that process, which is still incomplete. That is the incomplete enlightenment. Okay. So to reach it to its end becomes the systematic effort of the modern age from the viewpoint of enlightenment philosophy. But the fault lies in the fact that they see reason as the mechanism. The reversal of consciousness idea is already present there. What Sri Aurobindo is saying is that the true agent is the human aspiration. Actually, the true agent is the psychic being, because that is the carrier of the torch of human aspiration. So that is what allows the reversal to take place from an unconscious level to a conscious level. It comes to the front and becomes the agent for the pushing of evolutionary boundaries beyond what nature has achieved so far, into its culmination.
So that reversal, if you're saying that you use the word homeostasis, the encoded evolution in nature is lost, and it's up to the human after the reversal, then is there also the possibility that it could step backward? Because once you have the possibility that it's under the control of the human, then the human or some parts of the human could even, like, you know, spiral in the wrong direction, right?
Yeah, it could. But it isn't as if that it is completely, that the point he's making is that still even within that, there is an intelligence at work. Mm-hmm. That the divine intelligence, the cosmic intelligence is still at work. The human being may lose its way. So that's a point that both Mother and Sri Aurobindo have made in a variety of places, that we may not actually be the race that enters into the supramental condition. Or also the talking about the sort of, you know, the kind of retrogression, Mother has also, you know, posited the possibility that the human race may split into infrarational and a suprarational, or even three ranges, the infrarational, the rational, and the suprarational. And indeed, if we look at our times, we may almost see that there is the coexistence of the infrarational and the rational in our times, with a very small glimmering of the suprarational, you know, kind of appearing some maybe at places. But particularly over the last few years, and the last 1 or 2 years, the infrarational element has really, you know, kind of come to the front in a number of ways. And I think that possibility exists, that there would be a certain bifurcation or even trifurcation mm-hmm. into the infrarational, the rational, and the suprarational. But it's still under the cosmic, you know, some cosmic omniscience is still behind that process as well. A hidden some knowledge. As well.
I guess with the possibilities of growth and evolution also come the dangers of, you use the word retrogression.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes it a true adventure.
True, true, absolutely. That's where freedom lies. Freedom comes with its dangers.
Yeah, but in the ignorance, I guess there is also like you know, an impatience to get to the end.
Right.
But that's the very hallmark of ignorance, I suppose.
Debashish, during Sri Aurobindo and Mother's life, when they saw, you know, these tremendous counter-evolutionary forces that they had to battle, I mean, it's amazing that they still could see the mask.
You know,
the Nazis or whatever, that, you know, even how dark it became, they never lost the vision of their missions.
True. Because, of course, they were also, you know, operating from levels of consciousness much higher than ours. They were privy to those levels that, in which, you know, the freedom and the determinism are one. They were privy to that. So, you know, there is a tremendous amount of certitude in Sri Aurobindo and the mother's, you know, kind of knowledge of the inexorable destiny of the earth, of the world, and the inevitability of the supramental manifestation. That is so powerfully present everywhere, which is what gives us, you know, people wallowing in the ignorance, hope, you know. I would say that is the greatest anchor that they have given to us, the power of their certitude.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Justin, would you like to read next?
I would like to read. I have to make sure that I have the PDF page number that we'll be on.
We are on page 419. It's the paragraph that starts with "As with the cause."
Okay. As with the cause of ignorance, so is it with the consequences of the ignorance. As this that seems to us incapacity, weakness, impotence, limitation of power, our will's hampered struggle and fettered labor, takes from the point of view of the divine in his self-workings the aspect of a just limitation of an omniscient power by the free will of that power itself, so that the surface energy shall be in exact correspondence with the work that it has to do, with its attempt, its allotted success, or its destined, because necessary, failure, with the balance of the sum of forces in which it is a part, and with the larger result of which its own results are an indivisible portion. Behind this limitation of power is the all power, and in the limitation that all power is at work. But it is through the sum of many limited workings that the indivisible omnipotence executes infallibly and sovereignly its purposes. This power to limit its force and to work through that self-limitation by what we call labor, struggle, difficulty, by what seems to us a series of failures or half-balked successes, and through them to achieve its secret intention, is not therefore a sign, proof, or reality of weakness, but a sign-proof reality of the greatest possible, of an absolute omnipotence.
So what we have here actually is the way by which Sri Aurobindo talks about the mother in the book, The Mother, that it is really the omniscience, the omnipotence of the mother, the divine will at work in the universe, in the cosmos, at once operating through all its movements. Every movement of consciousness, every movement of will, is the movement of this one divine consciousness will, if you want to call it that. Omnipotence. And this leads actually to a couple of very important practical results in our consideration of our own energy, will, and action. And the first one has to do with exactly what Sri Aurobindo says in The Mother, that no individual can foresee the workings of the mother, that they are too vast, complex, and in a way fast for even the quickest intelligence, the most vast understanding to comprehend. It is infinite. It's an infinite wisdom at work, or infinite creative force at work in all its infinite constituents. Again, it's that notion of the one and the infinite at work. And so long as our finitude is in contact with it, we have to surrender to it. That's the only way in which we can come into some kind of alignment with that. But at the same time, knowing that is a great liberation. That is the great liberation of surrender to the mother, because we know that there is an omnipotence at work in everything. And that same understanding goes into the second practical consideration, which actually is the same, stated in a different way, which comes to us from the Gita. And Sri Aurobindo points out, because it has been a vexed question, the question of what is the meaning of nishkama karma, the work without desire, desireless works of the Gita. And he points out the meaning of that exactly in these terms, which is that no individual can really know what the cosmic omnipotence wants of it. So we are, as he pointed out in the previous paragraph, blind to the real intention of our work. We work according to the will of the mask. We work according to our limited and finite goals. But that covers another kind of intention, which is the one intent in the infinite mobilizations of forces in the cosmos. And it is only when we recognize that, we bring that duality into our own intelligence to start with. We bring into our minds, gradually let settle in our minds, the fact that we have a will, but the divine will is what really oversees all individual wills. That this idea of doing desireless works becomes a practical possibility. We begin seeing that it is by surrender of our will to this invisible omnipotence, which yet we have faith in, that our steps are guided towards the inevitable outcome, we begin recognizing the fact that success and failure doesn't belong to us, but belongs to the omnipotence, belongs to that will. That becomes practical. It is not that we have to accept as a kind of a convenience, or what they call making, you know, good out of necessity. If we fail or if we have some kind of result which we did not foresee, as some sort of either punishment or some divine wisdom that we can never come into contact with, but that we are operations of an omniscience and omnipotence, which is withheld from the mask. And so it is only by surrender to that, in the knowledge that some much greater wisdom and power than our own knows what is best for us, that we can do our works. The delight of the work is in the work, not in its result. Because literally, as it says there in the Gita, the result belongs to the Lord and not to us. So because it is the omnipotence that knows exactly what it is doing through us. And if it fails, it has decided to fail. Because in the scheme of the cosmic evolution, that is exactly what is needed at that point. And if it succeeds, that too is its own gain or its own, necessary result at that point. Because that is exactly what is needed in the complex, orchestra of the evolving ignorance.
So the sonnet of Sri Aurobindo, the Divine Worker, says, failure is cradled on thy deathless arm. Victory is thy passage mirrored in fortune's glass.
Beautiful.
Nice.
Do you have that sonnet handy? Maybe we can hear the whole sonnet?
It's not in front of me. Do you have it, Mateo?
Oh, not in front of me. I might get it pretty quick.
I might have it in my mind, but I'm not sure. I can try it.
Why don't you try it,
John? The Divine Worker. I face Earth's happenings with an equal soul. In all are heard thy steps. In all are heard thy steps. Thy unseen feet tread destiny's pathways in my front. Life's whole tremendous theorem is thou complete. No danger can perturb my spirit's calm. I do thy works and my acts are thine. I do thy works and pass. Failure is cradled on thy deathless arm. Victory is thy passage mirrored in fortune's glass. In this rude combat with the fate of man, thy smile within my heart makes all my strength. Thy force in me labors at its grandiose plan.
Indifferent
to the time snake's crawling length. No power can slay my soul. It lives in thee. Thy presence is my immortality.
Beautiful.
Yes, it captures so beautifully you know, what our attitude can be in terms of this very paragraph that we read.
Something in this paragraph is interesting to me in light of the beginning quote of the Isha,
yes.
The seer, the thinker, the self-existent who becomes everywhere has ordered perfectly all things from your sempiternal. In later translation, the translation that appears in the published Isha, he adds in an aspect of swabhava. The translation is the self-existent, the one who becomes everywhere, has ordered objects perfectly according to their nature from your sempiternal. So he puts in that aspect of according to their nature, which seems really reflected in this paragraph, and also pertains to the what we've been talking about with masks.
Yes. Yes, beautiful, beautiful. Yes, very true, very true. Because the limitation of power is what really causes the swabhava and swadharma to exist. That is the you know, self-limitation or the creation of the mask. The swabhava is the mask, actually.
Uh-huh.
The swadharma is the inevitable outcome of that mask, the active outcome of that mask.
So there are many layers of masks then, huh? So the swabhava and swadharma is also
essence,
comes after many unmaskings.
Many, many layers, very true. The highest layer would be in supermind.
Mm-hmm.
And then within the evolving ignorance, it would be the psychic being. And then as the ignorance, it would be the ego. So there are at least three masks. Two masks of self-concealment and one mask of, you know, concealment of the self.
Mm. So I remember a quote, I think it comes in the letters or perhaps in conversations, where Sri Aurobindo says that in this yoga you have to be born again and again many times over. So that is, do you think that's a reference to masks, or is that more like a, you know, evolutionary, like you have to kind of... I mean, what does that refer to? Sorry, I got lost in my sentence.
Yeah. Not only that, it's the evolution. It's actually that sentence, I'm not sure of where you're getting it from, but it's in the very first chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga, which is the condition of a material immortality is to be perpetually born in time. It's perpetually reborn in time. So, condition of a material immortality, it's the fact that, you know, there is a evolution taking place and the soul has to actually appear and disappear. These masks are appearing and disappearing in time. And that's, the mother says that the reason that people die is exactly that the self-limitation of the soul is something that can evolve. But of nature, there is, until nature reaches a certain power of self-expression, it only expresses a certain limited range. And therefore, it breaks. And a new nature has to be taken by the soul to manifest greater properties and a new mask, as it were. So, at the highest levels, what happens is that the nature is freely modulated by the appearances of the soul. In other words, the rebirth is taking place within the same life. You're being reborn, both soul and nature are being reborn in the same life.
And when you're able to do that, then there is no need of a material death.
There's no need of material death, exactly. That's one of the consequences from their point of view.
I think the context, I don't remember exactly where this came was. I think he first says to Nirodha, like, poets are born, not made. Mm-hmm. And then in response to that, I think he asks, is there no hope for me? And there he says, no, in this yoga, you have to be born over and over many times. And I forget the exact sequence.
Okay, interesting.
Is that in evening talks, Sean?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's in evening talks or probably 12 years, I think, one of those two.
Ah, thanks. I'm reminded the Sufis call finding the soul the death before death. In the context of as soon as we're dissolving at the time of death, the soul becomes very clear, so the objective of life is to bring that into being.
Into being.
Death before death.
Yeah. So it's the habitual the habitual mold of the prakriti, the mask of the prakriti, as it were, has to be dissolved for that deeper essence, the wearer of the mask, to emerge. And you're quite right that, I mean, from that point of view, that that's what happens at death, the dissolution of the prakriti, particularly of the bodily sheath of the prakriti, brings the soul to the front and makes the wearer be known to itself as the one that passes from body to body. Mm-hmm. And within the life, therefore, a similar death, which is within this body, must precede that same experience.
Ramon, would you like to read next?
Yes, sir. Excuse me. As to suffering, which is so great a stumbling block to our understanding of the universe, it is evidently a consequence of the limitation of consciousness, the restriction of force which prevents us from mastering or assimilating the touch of what is to us other force. The result of this incapacity and disharmony is that the delight of the touch cannot be seized, and it affects our sense with a reaction of discomfort or pain, a defect or excess, a discord resultant in inner or outer injury, born of a division between our power of being and the power of being that meets us. Behind in ourself and spirit is the all delight of the universal being, which takes its account of the contact, a delight first in the enduring and then in the conquest of the suffering, and finally in its transmutation that shall come hereafter. For pain and suffering are a perverse and contrary term of the delight of existence, and they can turn into their opposite, even into the original all delight, Ananda. This all delight is not present in the universal alone, but it is here secret in ourselves, as we discover when we go back from our outward consciousness into the self within us, the psychic being in us takes its account even of its most perverse or contrary, as well as its more benign experiences, and grows by the rejection of them or acceptance. It extracts a divine meaning and use from our most poignant sufferings, difficulties, misfortunes. Nothing but this all delight could dare or be to impose such experiences on itself or on us. Nothing else could turn them thus to its own utility and our spiritual profit. So too, nothing but an inalienable harmony of being inherent in an inalienable unity of being would throw out so many harshest apparent discords and yet force them to its purpose, so that in the end they are unable to do anything else but to serve and secure, and even themselves change into elements that constitute a growing universal rhythm and ultimate harmony. At every turn, it is the divine reality which we can discover behind that which we are yet compelled by the nature of the superficial consciousness in which we dwell to call undivine, and in a sense are right in using that appellation. For these appearances are a veil over the divine perfection, a veil necessary for the present, but not at all the true and complete figure.
So here we see that Sri Aurobindo is accounting for the suffering that we experience. And again, this paragraph is also very powerful because it leads to so many yogic implications. We can read from this a number of things that he talks about in the seven quartets in the Sapta Chatushta. For one, that this is really a consequence of self-limitation, experienced as self-limitation. But if, for example, we were to experience ourselves as limiting our own consciousness, it wouldn't be experienced as such. And the context of this limited consciousness with the shocks of the world are experienced as unbearable because of that. The force that stands behind the limited consciousness is not experienced as the omnipotence. If it was a self-limitation, then whatever force met us would also be recognized as just another potency of our own omnipotence. It would not come to us the same way, but as a reaction of delight or bliss. And so we see here, for example, he starts by talking about the kind of response of delight that we can experience in stages. And for one, it is the movement into what he talks about as the Samatha Chatushta, the quartet of equality, in which instead of feeling that whatever shock the nature has to bear is unbearable, we try to endure it, front it with equality. And that is the idea of titiksha, as he says in the seven Sapta Chatushta. So those three stages, it's behind in ourself and spirit, is the all delight of the universal being, which takes its account of the contact. A delight first in the enduring. Even in enduring, we recognize that we have something in us that is equal to the power that we have to endure. And, you know, the presence of the divine within us is something that we trust and have faith in to be able to withstand to whatever extent we can the shocks of the world, that through endurance. And once the power of endurance has increased, then we experience a certain transcendence of these shocks, something in us that is completely untouched, something in us that can remain above what he calls udasinata. So a delight first in the enduring, and then in the conquest of the suffering. The conquest of the suffering arises out of that form of transcendence, that there is no real suffering. The suffering is that of the self-limitation of the nature, of consciousness in the nature. While the soul experiences it as a certain kind of almost an illusion. But then there is an even greater in the Samatha Chatushtaya, the third term, of course, is Nati, which is surrender. So out of that comes surrender to the divine within us and outside us, giving us the experiences that we get. But even that is a stage towards what he calls Rodrananda. Rodrananda is the experience of bliss in even the intensest forms of inflicted pain. That there is an intense bliss, an intensity of bliss that we are not being able to bear, which causes us to experience it as pain.
Mm.
But if the transcendence can then be imposed upon the nature, then the values of our affective experience change. And we can experience it as bliss, which is something that Sri Aurobindo talks about in his own life. And the fact that he could transmute all experiences of pain and suffering into bliss.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he goes on in the remaining part to talk about. Not only is it something universal, but in each individual, this entire all delight is present. But then there is an even greater step, because the problem with this, if we take that as absolute, is again it denies the imperfection of things in the evolution.
Mm-hmm.
It is as if, yes, in essence everything is perfect, but in reality it is imperfect. And so the aspiration again has to drive the power towards a condition where this doesn't exist, where these experiences of pain and suffering are eradicated, as he says, through a rejection by the soul. And so that kind of a transformation not only of individual values, but of the possibility of evil in the world as the source of suffering, is an even higher degree of the manifestation of divine power. And all these are manifestations of degrees of divine power, emergent degrees of divine power of the soul in the individual. So the soul, the individual at the psychic level can go through, can express itself through these degrees, through endurance, through transcendence, through the change, through manifestation of delight in the responses of the self. But beyond the psychic level, the soul can rise to unity with the cosmic being, and even beyond that, to unity with the supramental being, where the very possibility of the existence of the causes of suffering can be eradicated. And so we see an entire trajectory which spells out the very goals of the integral yoga. Sri Aurobindo looks at it, seen from the dimension of the delight emerging through power into its fullness, and not only at the individual response level, but at the level of the cosmic manifestation.
Devada.
Yes, sir.
Devada.
Yes, Ramon.
Yes, sir. This somewhat reminds me of a very interesting, one of his interesting thoughts and aphorisms, where he actually makes a statement to the effect that he was the devil.
Do you know which one that is?
I can't recall offhand, because it's been some time back when I looked at it, and I had the feeling that it was because of something that you were just discussing, and that I read in the chapter and the paragraphs before that, that what you were talking about, the suffering and the all delight, and how he was able to transmute.
Yes.
That even the whole process of this, what we refer to the devil, is not at all what he's referring to.
Yes.
In other words, what he's referring to is that place where it's all delight.
Yes.
And what we're looking at it is something that we're so attached or identified with, the whole separation and the suffering, that we can't really, as of yet, really make that connection.
Yes. It's only at a very high level of the cosmic existence and maybe the supramental existence that that kind of identification can occur.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, which brings to the question, I mean, maybe a little frivolous, but even more so, like even in daily conversation, it exists, but even more so when we like talk of what the mother and Sri Aurobindo are saying, mm-hmm. How do we even know what they are talking about, you know, like in daily conversation too, I may not truly know what it is that you mean when you say a certain pain or yeah. something. It's just kind of like a general understanding. But like when you say mother and the Sri Aurobindo, they're talking of this consciousness and such more, quote unquote, sublime stuff.
Yeah.
What do we even know that what are they talking about? Like we may be totally lost, you know, that we're just in completely different worlds of experiences.
It's true. And yet it's its own evolution, actually, because indeed there is something within us that responds to some understanding of what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just a glimmer, but it's that glimmer which is the thread through which we can progress towards mm-hmm. greater understanding. But you're absolutely right. I think this point is a very important point that saves us, in fact, from fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very, very quick identification with this completely enigmatic mystery that they're represented by people like Sri Aurobindo and the mother, that, you know, that leads us to the grave defect of thinking that we know what they're talking about, mm-hmm. as you said. Mm-hmm. There is something infinitely beyond whatever we can understand in that utterance or in the consciousness that is uttering it. And so we are face to face with the supreme mystery, you know, and indeed it is only through progress that those glimmers can become more, you know, substantial and come gradually closer to that which utters mm-hmm. it, you know, to an understanding.
Interesting. And then in the case of, so that kind of understanding, like when the mother and the Sri Aurobindo are interacting, is that understanding being translated by language and words, or are they using some other medium for like translating each other's, you know, communicating each other's, I mean, I don't want to say thoughts,
it's occurring at many, many levels. And I think you were talking about 12 years. I think Niruddha refers to that. Refers to the fact that when the mother would come into Sri Aurobindo's room, sometimes the conversation was completely kind of beyond what they couldn't understand what was being said, because mm-hmm. it was like the tip of the iceberg. What they were seeing, the coming out in words, constituted, kind of a very small fraction of what was being communicated. A lot of it occultly, through just sort of direct communication.
Then we do not have the limitations of language. I mean, they may have its own limitations, but we don't have the limitations of like language and words at least, right?
Yes, yes. Exactly.
So if there are no other questions, given it's past 9:30, we'll stop for today and continue next time.
Sure.
So yeah, thank you everybody. I'll upload the audio recording and we'll continue 2 Saturdays from now.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Beautiful session. Beautiful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you everybody.
Thank you.
More glimmers this time. Okay.